Or I could return to Romans chapter 3, verses 21, 22, and 23, in a little paragraph. Romans 3, starting at verse 21. Now, we've been using the Concordant Version in our theme, as part of our theme, because we want to see if the Concordant Version has helped us at all and does help us to understand the evangel of grace, which the Apostle Paul brings to us, and I believe it does. But let's, could we try this together and read it together out loud, these three verses? If you have the Concordant Version, then will you read along with me now, just those three verses? Yet now, apart from law, a righteousness of God is manifest, being attested by the law and the prophets. Yet a righteousness of God through Jesus Christ's faith for all and on all who are believing. For there is no distinction, for all sinned and are wanting of the glory of God. Now, there's lots in these three verses. I spent a lot of time on them. I really enjoy this part of the scripture. This is Paul's introduction to the evangel that he is bringing. This is how he would probably begin his presentation of God's good news for today. He would probably begin with a statement somewhat what, like we have right here in these three verses. He had not visited the Romans when he wrote this letter. He did not know all of them personally. He knew some that had evidently gone there from other places that he had visited, but he didn't know, had never been there among them in Rome when he wrote this. And so he puts down the evangel as he presented it in a very concise and a systematized way, in a way, orderly way, I should say, step by step. I want to talk this afternoon on three things, and many of you have heard me speak on these before, but I don't think it ever hurts to go over it again. Three things. One has to do with God, one has to do with Christ, and one has to do with mankind. Now that's the proper order. Of first importance in the evangel and in the Bible is what it says about God. The second thing that we should be concerned with is what it says about Christ. And last of all, what it says about us. Now that's not our experiential order, is it? Because we begin the other way. And our interest and our concerns to start with are ourselves. What we get out of it all. And so that's what we're interested in. And we retain that kind of view through most of our lives. But there is a growth in our concerns about Christ and his honor and his position and his work and accomplishments. Now the prayers in Ephesians chapter 1 are for an appreciation and an understanding of his allotment and so forth. That which God has is giving to Christ. And then, of course, our part in all of that. And then last of all, I think our interest, not so much our interest, but our awareness and appreciation seems to be concerned with God. So that as time goes on and the eons unfold, there is the consummation of God all in all. And there is the full appreciation of God, and even Christ in his work at that point is to subject himself to God so that God might truly be all in all, and the I and even the Christ have now been given a proper place And God is all. So we have three things. And the pattern is, I'm sure, in parallel with the truth and shows the work of God's Spirit. Okay, what we learn about God is concerned with His righteousness. God is righteous. What we learn about Jesus Christ in this passage is that He believes God. Jesus Christ's faith. And what we learn about ourselves is that something is given to us or for us, done for us, and put on us. So we're pretty passive in the whole statement here. Now that's proper too, and that's very revealing. Now, this morning, in speaking about 1 Corinthians 15, I quoted A.T. Robertson to show how he recognized the true meaning of verse 26. Now let me read A.T. Robertson on this passage, verses 21 and 22. He says, "It's dealing with the God kind of righteousness through faith in Jesus Christ unto all them that believe." The God kind of righteousness through faith in Jesus Christ for them that believe. I've heard worse explanations of this passage. One that would be worse would be this. Here we have a righteousness which comes from God through faith, through our faith in Jesus Christ for us that believe. That would even be worse, I think. But this was pretty bad. Now, frankly, I have never, ever found a commentator who would say the same thing that I'm saying this afternoon about this passage. Not one. The righteousness of God. There are some that will say that that is talking about His righteousness, God's righteousness. But 95% will say that's impossible. God's righteousness cannot be in question, cannot be a matter of importance for us to consider. Cannot be a message, a basic message of the evangel. It's something we have to take for granted, and it's something that we shouldn't even bring up as a matter to discuss. Now, I've seen more accept the fact, the idea that it's Jesus Christ's faith. In fact, recently, a modern theologian has written a whole book about this called The Faith of Jesus Christ. And I have enjoyed seeing that he recognizes much of the key importance of this to Paul's message, that Jesus Christ believes God. Now, again, you can understand, can't you, why that does not seem to be a very important issue to Christians in general. Because why would he have to believe what God says, being the second person of the Trinity, or whatever, you know? Doesn't it lower him too much to think of him as having to believe, or believing? And certainly to relate that to this whole matter of justification and taking away the importance of our faith and giving attention, first of all, even before that's brought up, to his faith. That doesn't appeal and it doesn't seem to fit. Certainly isn't in accord with what we usually hear. But I believe that's what it is. Jesus Christ's faith. And the last passage, for all and on all who are believing, that's the third point. Here we have mankind brought into the situation. Jim was saying that the all is an adjective and it refers to whatever is in the context, then we just have to assume that this is mankind here. And I don't think we'll have too much objection to it. We do have believers. On all who are believers, but at least they are mankind too. Now here, of course, the matter is, this is pretty redundant to say it's for all and it's on all who are believing. Obviously, so the critic says, there's something wrong here in the manuscript, something wrong here in the Greek. And they've been saying that for a long, long time because the early manuscripts that we have are quite varied on that particular statement. The and, on, all, those three words are missing in some of the very oldest manuscripts. And many, many of the later manuscripts of the Greek in this passage of Romans. But one of the oldest manuscripts, the one that was found on Mount Sinai by Tischendorf in the 19th century, the Sinaiticus manuscript, has these three words added in the line, above the line, at this passage, by a correcting hand, an editor, who corrected the manuscript after it had been written. He was obviously using another manuscript, or perhaps even the original manuscript, and putting in what the copyist had left out. There are very few, there are many other early manuscripts that have all these words in it, those three words plus the other two, for all, and then the three words, and on all, are added in many manuscripts, the early manuscripts, not the 4th and 5th century, but 6th and 7th and 8th century. Most of them have all five words in there. The Latin Vulgate, strangely enough, has on all who are believing, and that's all. They don't have the for all. They just simply have on all who are believing. And so does one or two of the early church fathers, so-called, have just simply on all. Now the theory today by the critics is that the for all was all that was there in the original that was written by Paul. And that somewhere along the line, some copier changed the word eis, E-I-S, to the word epi, E-P-I, and put it into the text. Somewhere in the early times, he replaced the word eis by the word epi, by mistake. And then someone else came across his manuscript and evidently had two manuscripts, one that says ace and one that said epi, and he put them both together. That's the theory that's accepted now. That's a very complicated theory. And it's a very complicated explanation of what must have happened. And it's a very unusual explanation of what could have happened, because the critics of text, and anyone who's ever done any copying, have you ever tried to type a manuscript from something that had been written, and you type along from what was there, and you go on, and you'll find yourself that what you do is not add something or change something, but you leave something out. That's the easiest thing to do, and that's the most common type of error. And especially when something that is said is, you don't think, well, it's really necessary. If you're going to leave something out on purpose, you're going to leave out something that confuses you. Just saying, as the modern critics do, something's wrong here. And the word that really doesn't seem to fit is that word on, and doesn't seem to have any sense here, and so we'll leave it out because it just doesn't help. It's redundant. It's just repeating it. This should have been the reasoning of the textual critic, because that's their usual type of reasoning, and that's their usual way they look at this situation. I just wanted to say that as a matter of defense for the concordant version. But now I want us to consider the sense of the passage, because theories and ideas of criticism, they're not going to be the conclusive point anyway. The conclusive point is, what is it talking about, and what does it have to do with grace, and what does it have to do with God's work, and so forth. We're dealing then with the truth of God's plan and his purpose and the work of Christ. Okay, first of all, the evangel reveals or manifests the righteousness of God. Very few people think that's an important point. I think it is one of the most vital matters of our faith, that God is righteous. I've been translating the book of Job for the concordant version. I mean, I'm not really translating. I'm trying to refine it and make it into English so that it can be a part of the whole translation. But this is the whole point of the book of Job. It's the whole point of Job's struggle, is to see, is God really righteous? And I want to understand this. And he pleads, and he searches out, is God really right in what he's doing? Look what's happened. And it's not because of me that this has happened. And he looks at his associates there, and he argues with them, and he really screams at them about the whole matter. He just loses control out of himself, because he's entered into this so much. It's such a basic matter to him. And he says, all your solutions and all your ideas, they may be true, but they don't apply to the situation, and they don't explain it, and they're not really telling me how it can be that God is right in all this happening to me. Now, I know it's from God, but why? Now, that's the basic question it should be for every human being. And believers have gotten into the habit of, like the matter of evil that the sister brought up this morning, we got into the habit of saying, well, let's not discuss that. And I have sometimes been in Sunday school classes in churches, and the question comes up from the people to the Sunday school teacher. And he gives a pious answer like Job's associates gave to him about these matters. But the question is not really faced, not really dealt with fairly. Is God really right in what he has done? And you have the whole matter here in one way in the context in verse 25, where it speaks of his passing over of the penalties of sins which occurred before the Passover, and how God passed over the sins of Israel. And was that right? Was that right? He did not pass over the sins of the Egyptians, did he? He passed over the sins, and every year they had the Passover. And he simply passed over, imposing the penalty upon them. Because of the blood of a lamb. What did that do? It didn't do anything. But God did it. Was he right? That's a really important question. And it should be asked in Sunday school classes. And when the Sunday school teacher is presenting the book of Exodus to the class, the student should ask, was that fair? That's what we need to start out with. The evangel starts out with that question, with the answer to that question. It says that now this message is going to make manifest that God is righteous in everything he did and does and will do. God is righteous. Now, if Jesus Christ had not died on the cross, God, righteousness, could never be manifest. There's no way that we could show that God is right. There's no way that God could show that he is right. All the judgment and the condemnation of sinners would only be a further exhibition of unrighteousness. Bring a world into creation, putting them into this kind of environment, sinners, condemned, dying, suffering eternally, no righteousness. Like Jim was saying the other day, how can that be a matter of the justice of God? Eternal torment. So the good thing about the good news, the first good thing about the good news is that God is righteous, and we can see it, and it's been manifested now. Because what Jesus Christ did was that achievement of dealing with all that is wrong and sin and making it right. Well, I'm not going to go into the theories of sin for sin. Those that study the book, The Problem of Evil and the Judgment of God, can enter into some of the philosophy and some of the explanation of how this is right. But what I want us to see is that, first of all, the evangel is dealing with the manifestation of the righteousness of God, and it does do so. And it's good for us to begin by believing that, whether we understand it or not, to believe that this is God's righteousness and what manifests his righteousness and makes it possible to be understood and appreciated and loved and honored for what it is. Now, A.T. Robertson said of the righteousness of God that it's dealing with a kind of a divine righteousness that is given to the believers. Well, he missed the point. First of all, he should have dealt with what that divine righteousness, the importance of the divine righteousness in relation to God himself. Because the first thing is dealing with God. If Job could have understood this, and he did in the end, he just took it by faith. This was what solved the problem for Job, when he could say to God and really believe it, that God knew what he was doing. That God is able to handle the situation and had a reason for it and was going to gain his reason, his purpose. So, how important it is for us and for you and me and for all mankind and for those in the Sunday school classes again, how important it would be if they could just take that point and say that the evangel, the good news, the death of Christ on the cross is going to really present a solution to all this evil and wrong, and it's going to show that God is right in it all, and he has a reason for it. He's going to bring good out of it. What a marvelous thing it would be. That's why the first good news, part of the good news, is dealing with God. We need to start with our assurance about God, who he is. He is righteous. Our assurance about God. He is love. Our assurance about God. He is powerful. He is wise. Those matters. And those are the final things that we will grasp and really appreciate. And someday that will be all. I mean, it will be so overwhelming that it will be the most important thing to us. And we'll see that it always has been the most important thing. But God has chosen to do this through a certain channel, this manifestation of his righteousness. And the channel has nothing to do, again, with you and me, but it has to do with Jesus Christ. He is the channel, and it is his faith which is the channel. Jesus Christ's faith. Literally in the Greek, everyone recognizes this, it says faith of Jesus Christ. That's literally what it says. So the grammarians have come up with a rule which they call the objective genitive, and that seems like a contradiction in terms to me, but that's their idea. That it has to do with faith in him, even though it's the faith of him. Well, you see immediately that there's a difference, don't you? There's a lot of difference between faith in a person and the faith of the person. The faith of Jesus Christ is the channel through which God's righteousness is manifested. The faith of Dean Hoff would never manifest the righteousness of God. It could never be a channel through which he would choose and would successfully bring about a manifestation of his righteousness. The faith of Jesus Christ. And so that clearly to me refers to his faith there in perfectly and fully believing that God knew what he was doing and sending him. Facing the cross, Jesus Christ sweat, as it were, drops of blood, and said, "Not my will, but thine be done." Obviously, this was not his will. This was not his desire to go through the agony of the coming hours and the blackness of death which was the worst thing of all, but it was God's will. Paul says in Philippians chapter 2 that he was obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. The faith of Jesus Christ. Wherever has there been or ever will be faith like that? Nowhere. Brother was asking this morning about faith, and I know that wasn't his particular point, but it's what I got out of the question, and I've been thinking about it a lot, about our faith and how faltering it is, and what Jim said, "Help thou my unbelief," in quoting that passage. I believe, but help my unbelief. So that it will be changed into a stronger belief. The faith of Jesus Christ, how central, how essential, is surprising. If any of you have ever gone through the epistles of Paul and followed this theme, how it's surprising how often, and in the book of Hebrews too, the faith of Jesus Christ is referred to. And how essential it is. So as I was saying, there's this modern theologian that stumbled across this somehow, and he said, it looks to me like the Apostle Paul considered this a major point in the Evangel, the faith of Jesus Christ. And he was right, too, in applying this faith of Jesus Christ to the cross. Now, the faith of Jesus Christ manifests the righteousness of God, but it is true. Now, this righteousness of God, this righteousness of God is a distinctive righteousness. Paul said that in Philippians chapter 3, he said, "In the righteousness which is in relation to law, I was becoming perfect." He's talking about the years he spent as a Pharisee and his experience there as Saul of Tarsus and under the feet of Gamaliel and so forth, and his behavior, his discipline in relation to the law, becoming perfect, righteous. We might say that that was a Mosaic righteousness, a legal righteousness, even Pharisaical righteousness. Now, that's not the righteousness that's given to us. It's a greater righteousness than that. You read in the Old Testament that David, I don't know if it says David, but yeah, I think it does, that he was righteous. Several people, at least, are presented as righteous. In the New Testament, too, I know, there at the birth of Jesus, huh? Was it Simeon or Anna or some of them? They're said to be righteous. So there was a certain righteousness there. Because the standards were a certain way, and that was called a righteousness. But Paul gave up all that because of the superiority of the knowledge of Jesus Christ his Lord. And he became aware that God had given him his own righteousness, that kind of righteousness, such a standard of righteousness. In a sense, I think A.T. Robertson got that point at least when he spoke of the God kind of righteousness. This is the righteousness which is manifested about God. That is, he deals with everything that is wrong, with every evil that ever occurs or has entered into the world. And his righteousness brings about a justification of it all and a good end to it all. What a perfect righteousness. So that everything that God has done and everything he's brought into being and every act that he has purposed and has operated and has seen to be fulfilled, the sufferings of Job, every boil, every loss, every moment of agony and pain and suffering, God's righteousness has to deal with it. And so the righteousness that was manifested through the faith of Jesus Christ has to deal with each one of that. And that's the righteousness that is for all. Now the Concordant Version shows us there again the little I-O in front of the word for, and so it's into. And it's that righteousness is going to come into all. It's directed for everyone. If it were not, it would not be God's righteousness. It could not be God's righteousness. Comma. The righteousness of God through Jesus Christ's faith is for all. I don't think there's any manuscript that stops there at that point. That's kind of interesting to me. There's no manuscript that stopped there, because evidently none of the scribes got overwhelmed by that point. To me, I like to stop there once in a while. Just think about that. The righteousness is for all. Well, that settles the matter of universal justification as far as I'm concerned, because the righteousness which is through Jesus Christ's faith and is concerned with God's righteousness, it's for all. And if it's for all, then all are going to get it. But of course, these next words are a little bit hard to grasp. On all who are believing, especially in English they are. I don't know how they struck the Greek. There were many other scribes who just put them all down there. I believe that all five words were there in the original by Paul, very much in accord with the pattern of his thought. We can trace it out through the whole of his epistles. We rely on the living God, who is the Savior of all mankind. And then Paul deals with us, especially of believers. His thought was concerned with the work of Jesus Christ as it related to all the human race. And his thought dwelt on its special relationship of these truths to the believer in this world today. So this has been placed upon us, this righteousness of God which comes through Jesus Christ, faith. It has come upon us right now who are believing. This is really, in a nutshell, what he develops in chapter 4 about the reckoning of righteousness unto us. On all who are believing, we have already received its application in spirit. And then finally, Paul turns around and deals with all mankind again, showing the need of us all. Believer and unbeliever have sinned. Now, this passage to me is the one I immediately thought of when I saw that our theme was to be the Concordant Version and the Grace of God, or the Evangel of Grace. The Concordant Version hasn't done anything out of the ordinary here. It has simply translated the Greek in the ordinary way that the Greek would be translated. It doesn't say from, when all we have is of, or the genitive case, righteousness of God, and most other versions do the same. It doesn't add the word in to the phrase through faith of Jesus Christ, or take out the word of, or the possessive idea, Jesus Christ's faith. It doesn't decide that the manuscripts are wrong and redundant and we need to improve them. It just translates it all, for all, and on all who are believing. I think that's tremendously helpful and has opened up this whole passage into something that we can search into and deal with on a daily basis for years and years and years, and never reach a point where it doesn't enrich us.